Thank you, Dave. Good evening, everyone. I'm Graham. I'm an addict. Good to see you, everyone. Good to see you, Mikey and Christoph and Helen. It was nice listening to you just now, having a little bit of a bunny. It relaxed me a little bit. I'm starting to feel a bit nervous. After all, this is a rather prestigious event, probably the most important event of the year. And so it's good to see you guys just having a little bit of banter. That relaxed me. Right, okay, so I'm going to be sharing on step 10 and 11. Hello, Joe. Good to see you. Thank you very much for asking me. I'm not sure if that's true. Right, okay, so step 10 and 11. I don't really know where to go, where to start. I'm going to talk from the heart and just let it roll and see what comes out. Obviously, I've been thinking about what I might say, what I may or may not come out with. And it just occurred to me only seconds ago, just to start the step 10 share, recounting my last year. when I first came into recovery, my sponsor thankfully impressed upon me the vital importance of 10 and 11, and I was, you know, certainly, well, I've always have been, but I was a real zealot for 10 and 11, you know, probably going around hitting people over the head with a big book and talking about 10 and 11, because that's what my sponsor did to me. And, you know, I've come to learn how vital it is for me to continue in my own personal growth, and I guess in my ability to be able to contribute and take part in life, which was always really difficult. I remember the first going through the steps with my sponsor, and I remember reading the line, "Despite good intentions, we found ourselves to be in collision with people or things." And I wrote in the big book, I wrote in my big book in the margin in pencil. It's really faded now. This is me. I remember talking to him and going, "Oh my God, Si, this is me. I'll never wake up in the morning and like think I'm going to fuck some people up today." You know, I've always had a good heart. I knew I had a good heart, but somehow my desire to try and control things, even though I didn't know I was controlling them, just seemed to get in the way. And if everything was going my way, everything was wonderful. And yet when it didn't, it was as if my own emotional needs, desires, wants, ambitions, when they were not being met, you know, my own program for happiness, my own deep-rooted ideas and notions about how I thought things ought to be, you know, just come to the forefront. And, you know, and this child came out in me, you know. Petulant is a good word to describe me. And I've demonstrated certainly that petulance, you know, in adult life over and over and over again. Just checking the time, see where we go. Okay. So this last year, I've been in recovery for, well, in February it'll be 11 years. And this last year, starting in November of 2019, I've had to work this program and use the tools that have been given to me as if my very life depended on it, because it did. And it was exactly the same as when I first came into recovery. You know, just a hopeless cocaine addict, full of self-loathing. And I used to share at most meetings, you know, what a dog of a man I was, because that's what I thought I was. And that changed. You know, you loved me better. You know, you actually loved me better, until I could start loving myself. And so step 10 just played a massive role in, if you like, reconditioning my thinking, unraveling, you know, any of my old ideas about what I thought I was, and helping me to see something that I actually really was. you know, I hear so many times in shares, you know, and I don't agree with it. It's just an opinion. I don't agree with it, but I hear people saying I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. And I think, I am not selfish and self-centered to the core. Because it tells me so in the big book. You know, deep down inside, every man, woman and child is a fundamental understanding of God. So all I do, I need this program to help me find that, to help me find that that loving understanding that is within me, you know, my capacity to be able to learn to love people unconditionally, accept them unconditionally, and even to accept that their best may be what I consider their worst, but just accept it anyway. And along the way, finding out what I'm not, I guess, it's funny, it's a lovely little quote I found this morning, actually. I was just looking through my notes and, like all of us, I send loads of stuff out all the time. An absolute, you know, service junkie, and I love being bang in the middle with you guys. And I found this quote that I come across years and years and years ago, and it made me smile, and it just, you know, I'll read it to you anyway. Humility is not my forte. And whenever I dwell for any length of time on my own shortcomings, they gradually begin to seem mild, harmless, rather engaging little things, not at all like the glaring defects in other people's shortcomings. And I just thought to myself, yeah, there's a real sense of irony there. You know, I can look at my own defects and think, well, it ain't my fault. It's really not my fault. You know, I never started this. I just reacted, you know, and I could find my own justification in that. And as long as I held on to that, you know, I thought it was serving me, but it wasn't. It really wasn't serving me. And so resentment, you know, I looked up resentment and I found out that it actually meant to re-feel. And it just made so much sense to me, you know, to re-feel. You know, it talks about in a big book where it says we were sore, we were burned up. You know, that burning feeling that, you know, inside your stomach and your heart and your throat when you're incensed at someone else's behavior that, you know, that just seemed to be hurting, offending or threatening me. And I would lash out. I would always lash out. You know, in the past, when a resentment, you know, would get a hold of me and got its teeth into me, I had no way of dealing with it, and it kept on boring its way into me. And the only way that it was stopped was when someone got hurt. You know, and I don't mean physically, but emotionally and mentally, and normally my family around me. Someone always got hurt. And it would normally end up with, you know, me trying to fight for my own demands for affection and love and understanding. You know, why can't you understand? Why don't you hear me? Why can't you see me? You know, I felt invisible all my life. I was just so desperate for people to see me and hear me and understand me. You know, I wanted people to see how hard I was trying. And so the, you know, this bitterness and frustration, you know, would nearly always end up with me, you know, throwing my hands up in the air and shouting, and none of you give a fuck about me anyway, and storming out and going and using again and coming back, you know, full of guilt and shame again. So for me, step 10, I guess, pain driving us to that point where we have to take action. You know, alcoholism beating us into a state of reasonableness, you know, willing to listen, willing to learn, willing to do whatever it takes, you know, learning a new practice, a new discipline. And so literally I took it all at you know, whatever my sponsor said, you know, like so many of us see here said, whatever he said, I did. And I remember talking to him about, he said to me once about 10 and 11, he said, look, normally with my sponsors, he said, I'm on their case for a year of writing at least. He said, but with you, it's going to be 18 months. He went, I want to make sure. And I'm glad he did that. I'm glad he helped me. He held my hand and he helped me instill a discipline that, that I still do to this day and has been vital and saved my life so many times. And, you know, even at the beginning, it was funny, actually. Like I said, I was a real zealot for Step 10. You know, it's like everywhere I went. I remember driving down a road once and the resentment came up. I can't even remember what it was. It's, you know, so important, but I can't remember what it was. But I remember desperately rummaging around in the car for something to write on. And I ended up ripping up a McDonald's Happy Meal box just so that I could get it down on paper and, you know, take literally what my sponsor had said. You know, when dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. You know, working it out in your head, Gray, that's what got you here. You know, you need to set this down on paper, mate. And I tell this to my sponsees, you know, when you're doing step 10 and setting it down on paper, and you've got to that point of willingness to do it and humility, you know, you've said your prayer, your step 3 prayer, you know, you've turned your will and your life over to God, you're willing to take action, right? That humility, that whole process, and you get to the point where you're putting pen to paper, try writing down a lie. Try and write down a lie. I can't. You know, I'll tell myself a million lies in my head over and over again, you know, to justify, you know, and literally within seconds of a thought, another thought and another thought and another thought. How do you unravel that? But yeah, that point of, you know, humbly admitting that I'm powerless over people, places, things, alcohol, cocaine, and then being willing to write it down. Try writing a lie. Yeah, it's an incredible tool, you know, that we now understand as massive, you know, psychological benefits, you know, that have been studied over the last, you know, 100 years. And it's just, you know, the experience, you know, that of Bill and Bob and what they've written in this book out of their own experiences has just been underpinned by so much scientific proof since and psychological proof. And the real benefits of it, you know, it's helped me massively. I've been sharing in meetings for over 10 years and the people that know me and the people that have been in meetings, you know, close to me, have heard me share so many times about my wife, about how much I loved her, about how much guilt and shame and pain I felt, you know, for the years of my addiction and what I put my family through, and how determined I was to make amends for the rest of my life, you know, and be the kind of man that I wanted to be. And any lengths, you know, to be a good man, a good dad, and a good husband, you know, a good son. You know, over the years, unconsciously or otherwise, I've done so many things that, you know, I felt full of shame. And my wife pulled me through so much. She lifted me and carried me through so many difficult times. And I thought, oh, wow, this is just a God-given gift of recovery to be clean and sober and find a way of living and giving of myself and filling myself with, you know, self-esteem by my actions, And the last few years, the last 4 or 5 years have been really, really, really tough between me and my wife. And I desperately did so much to try and change and be everything I thought she wanted me to be. I wanted to grow old with her and love her to our final days. And then after 29 years of marriage, in November last year, she left me. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, what is it? What's it all about? Was it all worth it? You know, trying to become a good man and doing all this, and she left me anyway, left me heartbroken. And it was a really, really tough time. It really was a tough time. And some close friends in recovery and my sponsor, you know, you just held me again like you did 10 years ago. And you guided me and lifted me, carried me, loved me, listened to me, heard me. And said to me, listen, Graham, you need to work this program. You need to carry on working this program like your life depends on it, because it does. And you're not going to feel like helping anyone or working this program or praying or meditating or doing service, but you must. And every single day, I'd get out of bed and say my prayers and, God, I'm so scared. And I've been given some wonderful prayers and stuff that sustained me and helped me through, even though I didn't know it. Just putting one foot in front of the other was just so, so difficult. And I promise you this with all my heart, absolutely with all my heart. I did not want to drink or use. I absolutely did not want to drink or use. You know, I kept saying to myself, you know, I'd get out of bed. I'd literally roll out of bed onto the floor because I didn't even want to get out of bed. And I'd say to myself, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we can see our experience can benefit others. God, I'll take that, please. I'll take that. Just help me through this. And day by day, one day at a time. I mean, I wanted to commit suicide so many times. I thought, I can't do this. This pain is too much. I remember doing my fear inventory and getting to that point of, you know, of understanding that, you know, if I sit in fear for and pain for too long, I'll use. And yet what I found out and what I know is that no amount of drugs or drink could ever have taken away that pain. But God did. You did. You know, you showed up as God in my life, you know, as love and support, and you helped take that pain away. No amount of drink or drugs could have done that. And so I just gradually just worked my way through it, you know. Some days just in agony, literally just in agony. And I carried on sponsoring, and I was on the phone and I was doing service, and I was waking up some morning and thinking, do I really want to fucking sponsor someone today? Do I really want to help someone today? Do I really want to listen to a newcomer talking bullshit today? And yes, I needed it. I didn't know it, but I needed it, and I did it anyway. I'm eternally grateful for that. So step 10, you know, has helped me to learn an awful lot about myself, get to the truth, uncover a lot of things that I thought I was that I'm not. You know, the God in me, being able to see the God in you. So I'm eternally grateful for that. and I continue to do it now. And do you know what? I about May time, I was really struggling, and I was resentful at my wife for leaving me and taking everything. That was the resentment. I'm resentful at my wife. She took everything from me. Everything I believed in, desired, loved, wished for, my family unit, my children, my home. And I went through the columns, and once again it revealed the truth to me. I prayed, I asked God, please let me see the truth about my resentments. So I went through that. I wrote three A4 pages on this one resentment. And at the end of it, as my sponsor had always instructed me, he said, "Gray, I want you to write at the end of your step 4 inventory or your step 10 inventory, I want you to write my corrective measures. And I want you to pray on it what my corrective measures will be." And something come to me. And so what I did is I wrote three columns on the next page. And in the first column, it was, "I have lost." And in the second column, it was, "I have not lost." And in the third column, it was, "I have gained." And I wrote down about 20 things in that first column, "I have lost." And when I looked at it, I changed the title at the top, because none of those things that I actually lost were the things that I thought I'd lost. So I changed it to, "I have been freed from." I've been freed from the fear of living in her shadow. I've been freed from the fear of not being enough. I've been freed from the fear of constantly not having enough self-worth or thinking that she loved me. And it went on and on and on. I've been freed of so many things. And I had not lost my children. I'd not lost my love, my fellowship, everybody that I loved in CA. I'd not lost my health, my job. I'd not lost my courage. And I had gained so much. I'd gained a true realization for the first time about how much you loved me, how much I was loved, and actually what a good man I was. You know, I gained an opportunity to find out who I really was. You know, I'd gained so much. And this was all because of step 10. You know, the truth just revealed itself to me as I made myself, you know, receptive to the truth. And so step 11, I don't know, I'll ramble on. I'll get carried away and just I'll ramble on and ramble on because I just love this stuff. So my first 4 years probably of meditation was probably consisted of just, you know, on awakening and you know, not just, you know, passing it off, just quickly going through it. You know, there was depth, there was thought, and there was consideration in my on awakening and my nightly review. Like I said, for 18 months, I mean, I've got, I don't know how many A4 pads of a written nightly review. And it doesn't say do a written nightly review, but my sponsor wanted me to do one for 18 months and I did. And funnily enough, we discussed it most nights anyway and talked about it. And we had some wonderful conversations and, you know, and he opened me up to things I was so prejudiced about. And I changed my perception about so many things. I'm not even the same person. You know, I was closed-minded and fairly bigoted and prejudiced and arrogant and thought I knew it all. And the older I get, you know, the more I realise I know less and less each day. And actually, that's good, you know. But so, yeah, the first 4 years, you know, I probably didn't actually sit in active meditation that often. And then five odd years ago, I met my current sponsor at a convention in Birmingham, and there was a centre in prayer meeting at 6 o'clock one morning. I thought, oh, yeah, I'll go to that. And And that was when my practice of prayer and meditation really kicked off. And I've gained some unbelievable benefits from that. And do you know what? I read it somewhere. I can't even remember where. I was reading a book, and there was a sentence in there, and then there was this one small sentence that literally just jumped out the page of me, and it said, being half anywhere is the beginning of true loneliness. And I felt that. I just absolutely felt that. You know, it's almost felt like my whole life I was here wanting to be there, there wanting to be here, even at my own dining table with my wife and my kids, you know, not feeling part of it, you know, and not knowing why. And, you know, in some of the prayers that I do, you know, there's a line that says, you know, stealing the sense of your presence. You know, I'm I'm a victim of my memory and my imagination. You know, my memories will come up and I'll look at them and I'll replay them over and over again and, you know, desire the good times, you know, as if they can come back again and again, repeated exactly as they are, you know, pretty much the same as, you know, the first time I took cocaine and carried on, you know, trying to find the first time that it actually made me feel powerful. You know, it gave me, I thought at that time, you know, an infinite power, but it wasn't. You know, or I'm just constantly, you know, living to my imagination and my projections of what ifs and if onlys, and maybe I can make that work, and if I'm in control. And it doesn't work that way. The crazy thing is, as soon as I realize that I'm not in control and I let go of trying to be in control, my life becomes so easy and relaxed and serene that there lies the control. You know, it's being out of control means that everything is going as it should, not as I want it to be. And so meditation, you know, I practice centering prayer meditation. And like all of us, you know, I'll judge it immediately, or I'm judging it while I'm doing it. You know, I'm sitting here and I've got a thought, and a thought comes in. And so immediately, because I don't know any better, I attach a label to that thought as that's a bad thought. So then I try to control that and think, right, okay, I need to think of a good thought. Let's think of a God thought. Let's think of a kind thought. Let's think of a serene thought. Let's not think of any thought. But what I'm learning, I don't know where I heard this, read it. Maybe I didn't. Maybe I make it up in my head. You know, there's so much we're blessed with finding out as we open ourselves to this stuff, is that there's no room for debate in meditation. It just is. And as I've started, only recently just started becoming more forgiving of myself in meditation, it just seems to be just what it is. Just what it is. You know, I don't, you know, if I sit there and try not to try to meditate, if that's possible, and just let it be, whatever's happening, let it happen. Just, and if a thought comes, the thought comes, and if I run with the thought, I run with the thought. And because what do I know? How do I know that that's not God sending that thought to me that needs to work its way through, maybe to the surface? Or, you know, I've spent so many years burying so much stuff because it was painful. Why try and control a thought that's coming to the surface somehow? I don't know. I'm not trying to be any kind of authority on anything. It's just my experience. You know, even while I'm meditating, it just seems to make sense to me now that if a thought comes in, then maybe that thought, you know, has got some validity in some way, and just to relax and let it be, and let it come and let it go, but not try to control it coming or going. I don't know. I really don't know. I really don't know. But I've certainly become becoming less judgmental of myself. And you know, all of this, you know, all of this stuff that we do, you know, it's like the step 10 promises, and I paraphrase badly probably, but you know, it says something along the lines of, in the step 10 promises, you know, we develop a new attitude towards liquor. And it comes without any thought or effort on our part. And that really, really intrigued me. I thought, well, if I spent so many years desperately white-knuckling it, sitting on the end of the bed, hitting myself over the head, desperately, desperately trying not to use, I'm not going to use today, I'm not going to use today, all my focus and energy, everything, trying not to use. And then I used. So how does this promise it work? You know, step 10 promise. It comes without any thought or effort on our part. Where is the thought and effort then? And the thought and effort is practicing the steps. Making the steps every bit of your awakening moments. You know, your prayer and your meditation and your letting go and your surrender and your writing, your step 10 every day. That is the thought and effort. You know, our altruistic movement, helping others. You know, we become what we think of. If I spent all those years desperately trying not to use, that's what I became. I became what I thought of all the time, and all I ever thought about was cocaine. But my sponsor introduced me into a new habit. You know, and that habit was working the steps and being part of recovery and all the things suggested. And so I became what I thought about. You know, that was the thought and effort on my part. And, you know, the desire to use just left me. You know, and even in this last year, the most painful year that I've ever had in my whole life, the desire to use and drink was not there. That, you know, that to me is a miracle. You know, and as a result of step 10, you know, the resentments that cropped up in this last year, being able to process them through step 10, you know, and through the, you know, through steps 6 and 7, 8 and 9, and then 11, you know, being able to start letting them go. I am so, so proud of myself. You know, I split up with my wife of 29 years. I've conducted myself with dignity, with love, and with understanding. We have not fought. We've been kind to each other. We've helped each other. I've left our family home. You know, we've tried to help each other financially. My daughters have seen a dad to be proud of. I feel like a man that I'm proud of myself. You know, and this new beginnings at 57, I did not want to start my life over. I did not. Everything I thought I ever wanted was in that family home. And yet I'm here. I'm still here now. And I'm learning about me, and I'm, you know, experiencing new things. And I'm remarkably happy. I'm really happy. You know, I've spent the last 6 months with my daughter, living with my daughter, and she got me a Christmas card. And obviously we've been locked down the last God knows how long, and we've been cramped in this. I'm living in my grandson's bedroom, which is great, and that's a blessing. And I spent time with my grandson, and I got this card today from my daughter, and it says, "Just a little card to say how much I've thoroughly enjoyed spending lockdown with you this year. I've relished in the opportunity to annoy the fuck out of you every single day. Merry Christmas." Blessings are where you find them. And I'm eternally grateful for being part of this program, for the love and support and guidance that you've given me, for the courage and willingness to work this program, even when I didn't want to do it, and the benefits that I've found. You know, life is good. Life really, really is good. Sometimes you have to take a lot of shit on board, and this last year has been tough. But I needed to be. I was exactly where I needed to be and where I had to be for my own growth. So I don't know how long I've gone for. That's probably about it. So I'd just like to say it's an honour to be here. Thank you, Joe, for asking me. Thank you for... I felt welcome, even though you're all on mute. And Mikey, thanks for the odd little smile there and then acknowledging me. Thank you, mate. It's been wonderful. And God bless you, and have a safe and healthy and wonderful Christmas. Thank you.